We are still not aware of how much we do that's communicative. You know, we think of speaking as communication. We might think that someone's deliberate clothing choices are, but we forget how much of what we do, whether it's our gestures or the accent in which we speak, have socially communicative functions to them.
Have you ever been in the middle of a conversation and just gotten bored? Maybe that weird neighbor of yours is telling you for the 30th time about his family reunion in Wisconsin, all the potato salad he ate, and the amazing three-legged race in which he and his Uncle Bruno came from behind in the last 20 seconds to win the gold. Conversations like this are great opportunities to sit back and observe the other person. What are they communicating? Aside from how tough it is to win a three-legged race when your partner has hyperhidrosis. Pay attention to signals. Look at their body posture and facial gestures. Examine their clothing and hairstyle. Listen to their choice of words and turns of phrase. How close are they standing to you? If other people are listening in, how are they reacting? All of these signals help you create an impression of people. These impressions, in turn, help you develop your social world and personal belief systems, engage with culture, and establish relationships of trust. The awesome part of this kind of signaling and interpreting is that a lot of it happens behind the scenes and at lightning speed. Face to face, we can look people in the eye, develop an impression, and react appropriately, all within fractions of a second. Well, that kind of stuff doesn't work so well online. The truth is, the web has kind of rewritten the rules for signaling. In many ways, the web is almost autistic. The words we share over social networks are missing a large element of the emotional and situational context. Identity online can be easily manipulated as well, creating huge barriers to trust. But online identity cues are unique and evolving, presenting amazing new ways of communicating signals that enhance our relationships with others. Judith Dunneth is the director of the Sociable Media Research Group at MIT. She is developing a theory of how human signaling works online, and exploring how online systems could be better designed to improve human communication and trust. We sat down with her late last month to get an idea of how signaling theory works.
Signaling theory comes from theoretical biology, and it's a way of looking at communication and trying to understand what keeps it honest. If you think about it, it's actually quite profitable to be dishonest, to say that you're nicer, better, smarter, more well-intentioned than you actually are. Same is true for animals. If they could say, oh, I would be a fabulous mate for you, or if you come near me, I will eat you for dinner, even if they're not strong enough, etc., they would be better off. However, if all communication was dishonest, there really wouldn't be any communication. It would be sort of pointless. And what signaling theory does is it tries to understand and model effectively what are the economics of communication that keep signals at least honest enough to for communication to occur.
How does that work in the animal kingdom? How do you kind of decide what an animal is communicating honestly versus dishonestly?
Let me just tell you a little bit about how it started. There's a Israeli biologist named Amot Zahavi, and he was looking at some puzzles in evolution. For instance, there's the peacock tail that Darwin had said, you know, whenever I see a peacock, it makes me sick, because it just didn't seem to make sense given all the it didn't seem to help for survival. It's very costly. And so Zahavi came up with this theory that he called the handicap principle, which was that if you have a lot of a resource, you can show that you have that resource by wasting it. And one who has just enough of that resource to survive can't be wasting it. So one example that he gives is gazelles stotting. And what they do is very fast gazelles, when certain predators come after them, instead of running away, they'll stand in place and jump up and down, which seems really counterintuitive. They're wasting time, they're wasting energy. But studies have shown that indeed the predators go after the ones who aren't doing this. And the application of the understanding based on this theory is that it's a way of signaling, I am really, really fast. You don't want to waste your energy going after me. And for the gazelle, I guess it's more energetically costly still to tear off at full speed. So this way they can use less energy but still signal that they're very strong, because the ones who are slower can't do that. You know, because if the predator does go after them, they would need that lead time. So if you think of a kid, like kids in a playground, and there's a bully coming after them, the really slow kid is going to run, whereas the really fast one can sit there and like thumb his nose and say, you know, you can't catch me, and then run away. So it's that's the understanding there.
And it sounds like, so signaling isn't what you're communicating literally, like verbally.
That could be too. I mean, it's. I mean, one of the definitions that I use is that it's anything that has that's intended as communication. Either it has evolved for communicative purposes, or it's you know intentional. You meant to communicate that, like when you're speaking to somebody. And the reason that's important is you want to distinguish between cues, which are anything that you use to find out about the world around you. And within cues, there's signals and then what I call evidence, or you could call them non-signaling cues. But you give off CO2, and a mosquito uses that to come find you and bite you. But you weren't communicating to the mosquito. You're giving off CO2 for reasons completely unrelated to the mosquito. And as far as mosquitoes go, you'd be happy not to do that. So that's evidence of your presence. That's not something you're communicating. The reason it's important for this theory is that signaling is really about the checks and balances that keep something honest enough. So that if some other animal comes around and figures or evolves a way to mimic something, you might need a costlier signal or some other type of signal. And to some extent, it's sort of a constant shifting evolution of signal making and signal copying and understanding.
And so we're communicating all the time, no matter what we're doing, mm-hmm. as long as we exist on right. the planet, we're communicating something. What's the application for human beings?
Well, there's a couple of things. On one end, I'm interested in really getting people to make that understanding that how much communication goes on around us. You know, even if you look back at the animal version, it's really about a view of saying, you know, all the evolutionary theory went on for like 100 years and people didn't really think that hard about things that had been evolved to communicate, whereas that's actually a very important function. And I think we are still not aware of how much we do that's communicative. You know, we think of speaking as communication. We might think that someone's deliberate clothing choices are, but we forget how much of what we do, whether it's our gestures or the accent in which we speak or the other choices about how we do things, you know, even things like what programming language we choose to work in, have socially communicative functions to them. So one part is I want to help to highlight where all this communication is in our daily life. In terms of the theory itself, I'm interested in understanding how we want to adapt it for human, to understand human beings, because either it's possible that our understanding of animal communication is very naive, and I'm happy, you know, if there's evidence that they are actually more sophisticated communicators, that's fine. But the theory that's been developed for understanding animal communication is primarily based on these costly signals. There's relatively little social punishment of dishonest signaling, where there's a tremendous amount of that in human society. Because we can establish reputations and socially enforce different norms, it means that we can rely on much more flexible signals that aren't necessarily very costly, because the cost of deception, punishing deception, is then paid for by the community. We also have a much more sophisticated understanding of other states of mind. So the levels of deception that we can try to do are a lot more sophisticated. We also have an inner morality. So our understanding of cost and benefits also comes from the training and religions or whatever beliefs we have about what's right and wrong. So there's a whole series of things that are quite different about human signaling that still fit into the model but require expanding it.
What sort of examples of deception in human communication are you seeing?
You know, one of the examples I use is, you know, that anyone who has children knows that a great deal of raising children is about teaching them to lie. You know, if you have a little kid, they will, you know, stare at people who have some kind of deformity. You know, they'll say, "Grandpa smells bad." They don't like the present you gave them. They're really honest, and they'll say exactly what they think. And a tremendous amount of what you do to make people who are polite, et cetera, is teach them to lie. I mean, some of it might be lies of omission and some might be lies of commission. You know, oh, that's the loveliest shirt I've ever seen. So a lot of it is simply to be a functioning member of society. You have to deceive. I think people who are never deceptive are probably in straitjackets. So that's a big piece of it. It's just there's a tremendous amount of everyday deception. But I think it's also, I mean, we live in a society where I think because, you know, in the animal world, there's this notion that there's all these signals and they're pretty robust and honest. And there's just not a good way for an animal who doesn't have this quality to present the signal. And in the years I've been studying this, I have not really been able to come up with like an ironclad example of something that humans do to signal something that they do not attempt to cheat or make a cheaper version of. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at, we have a huge plastic surgery industry. Mm-hmm. The whole cosmetics industry to some extent is a deceptive signaling one. There's also more subtle pieces about what is trying to better yourself versus being an imposter. So, you know, the issues of what is deception, what kind of deception do we celebrate, and which ones do we punish, is not always that straightforward.
Well, when you brought up the child example, the one of the immediate deceptions that came to my mind was when you're taught as a kid to stay away from strangers, and if a stranger comes and talks to you and says, hey, your mom said I should come pick you up from the playground, you know, you're supposed to make up something to deter the person from talking to you. And it seems like in that case, dishonesty is a defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. Maybe in the animal kingdom, there's an analogy there where you have animals who try to blend in with their background.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's constant. You know, for instance, if you have a cat, and if your cat gets scared, the first thing it does is all its fur stands on end because it's trying to look like a bigger cat that would be more dangerous and you wouldn't want to go and attack. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's little things like that that you can say are deceptions. And I think one of the things that's hard here is English doesn't have a good word for deception that's not highly pejorative. Mm. So what often the phrase I use is, it seems it's a little vague. It's just to say this is not a reliable signal, you know, or something's unreliable because it doesn't necessarily give you exactly the information you thought. And in the human world also, there's a tremendous amount of interpretation. And that's something that in the animal world, I think is just not that well understood. You know, for instance, let's go back to those gazelles for a second. So here's this gazelle starting. It's jumping up and down. And here's a predator. And that predator goes after it. Did it not understand what this was about? Just like it sees a gazelle like dinner jumping up and down and thinks, just had no idea what this was supposed to be about. Is it that it does that once and then that gazelle takes off really fast and then it learns not to do it, not to go after those again? Does it see other predators not going after them? You know, is there an issue of like with slow ones, would it just not believe it? So we don't know any of this. With humans, it's just much more clear that we could say, okay, well, this person did this and we're pretty sure they meant to indicate X, but this person didn't even recognize that something was going on. They didn't even notice. This person is from another culture, and it could be a slightly different subculture in the same city, but they're enough of a different culture that it has a very different meaning to them, or this person has different beliefs and interpreted other aspects of it in some way. If someone wears a fur coat, they're probably not intending to signal, I'm cruel to animals, but someone else might take it as evidence that they are.
And fashion is one place that you've really been looking at in terms of how people communicate.
My interest in fashion, again, it's one of those places where there's a little lack of the correct vocabulary because I'm not looking particularly at clothes, though clothes have that fashion change. What I am interested in is what I mean by fashion is signals that indicate your position in society and maintain their honesty, not through being expensive in terms of time, but through requiring constant renewal in a new form. So you have to, what it means is that it's a way of displaying your access to information in some way, as well as other things, because if it's expensive clothing, it's also going to be a signal of wealth. But the piece that I'm particularly interested in, especially because of its online implications, is how staying in fashion requires constantly changing the way you do something, whether it's what you wear or the management fashion you espouse at your consulting company. But you have to be willing to adopt. And the further ahead in that fashion cycle you are, the more risk you have of being wrong. Because at the sort of head end of things, there's going to be all kinds of new stuff coming in. And part of it is, if you want to be at the forefront, you have to be willing to assume that risk of not adopting something once the whole mainstream has caught on to it. So either you're just have a high tolerance for risk, or you are very, very knowledgeable or very influential.
And so some might see you adopting a certain style, whether that be in clothing or mannerisms.
Slang, you could look at it in slang. You could look at it in the things people talk about on their blogs for a very fast or almost daily thing. You can look at, you know, Twitter has a version of fashion where something is like a new topic. Well, there's people who are really into the idea that, you know, they're going to start talking about things that are new. They don't want to talk about it, be sending that link out 2 days later. You know, and a lot of their reputation is based on being on the forefront. Mm-hmm. There's interesting work that's been done in looking at programming languages, because they have a real style to them. There have some innovation aspects, in that some are better than others, or some might make something easier than others. But there's a huge fashion component to it, because it's very risky to adopt a new one. People invent new languages, and sometimes they give up on them. Mm-hmm. So you port everything to this language, and then it disappears. Or you port everything to this language, and it just turns out to be fairly buggy, or it's not really kept up very well. So if you're going to be at the forefront, you really need to be knowledgeable. You also have to be willing to take on this huge cost to be someone who uses the coolest new programming language. You know, the first person to use Ruby, the first one, you know, that you know who uses Scala, and rewriting tons of stuff that you had already. And particularly, and it's in a world of people who don't normally think of themselves often as being fashion driven.
If you have something that's very trendy, it might also mean that you've got, you know, a lot of pretty high elites, as you were saying, who are promoting this, using this, just by using it, they're promoting it. But if you have, you know, a smaller group of people, or just one or two people, that could end up meaning that this is an anomaly and not a fashion. So how do you separate for those? How do you account for that?
Well, I think the what's interesting is watching how it moves through a society. So it's, I mean, that's something that just gets separated over time. You see what happens to it. I mean, another piece, and this is particularly interesting when you look at things like programming languages, is that there is the fashion component is very much the social component about signaling your place in a society. But there's also a utility component. This is, you know, so it's a very similar cycle when you look at things like Everett Rogers' diffusion of innovations, where what he was looking at was simply how things diffused based purely on their utility. And what I'm interested in is how they diffuse based on a social message. Certainly something is going to diffuse better if it's also useful. But the more useful it is, then the less valuable in some ways it is as a fashion, because lots of people will adopt it not as a way of showing their social affiliation, but because it just made good sense to do it.
What's an example of that?
Well, you could see that often in, I mean, you see it certainly in clothing, where many types of high fashion clothing tend to be really uncomfortable, like women's really truly uncomfortable shoes, where in some ways it's a way of saying there's no reason why I would be wearing this other than a fashion statement, because I can't walk in it. I'm in terrible pain and I'm ruining my feet, but I will pay those costs to wear it. Whereas, you know, a pair of sensible shoes, you're not, it's hard, even if you introduced a pair, and this happens fairly often, that are fairly comfortable and they might be fashionable, they'll be fashions for a briefer time because they will take off much more quickly into a very big mainstream if they're very utilitarian.
Like Crocs or Keds, for example.
Yes.
What's the case in online communication of a trend versus utility?
Well, one aspect might be, let's go back to Twitter, is if there it's much more of a information fashion in terms of like daily links. What are like the stories to be talking about? What's an idea to be passing around? And there the risk can be in sending around unverified information. So when there's like a big topic, that's one of the things you see. There's people who really want to be the first to say, this is happening, this is it, I know what's going on. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. So I remember a lot during the Iran election, you know, people would say, oh, here's like, this is real, this is the real news, this is going on there. And like, you know, 2 hours later, well, actually, let's just retract that. So that, I mean, that's an example of being at the forefront, being very risky, whereas the person who has seen this 900 times and has seen it in the New York Times can go and repost it fairly confident in not embarrassing themselves if this gets retracted. And so there, that's more about being at the forefront than the issue of the utility per se.
That's an interesting example because in Twitter has brought up a lot of that stuff about a lot of unverified information that comes out in the forefront. So you've got a lot of people bringing up some potentially misleading topics that wouldn't have made it out without something like Twitter.
Right.
Is there a usefulness in your mind of having that kind of method of communication so prevalent?
You know, I think all of these things fit into a whole information landscape. So I think if you decided to get all of your news of the outside world through Twitter, you would be in trouble. I don't think it's very reliable. But it is, you know, given all the other sources, it's certainly a good way of ferreting things through and just kind of bringing up lots and lots of stuff. I mean, the fact that it's ended up being fairly good at spreading false rumors, I think is something that it makes more sense to deal with like a sort of Twitter Snopes like site. So I think that would be the next development there, but not to try and get people to do this less. They won't.
Or maybe just people have an unconscious association with Twitter, or a conscious association, I don't know, with Twitter, that they say, okay, well, I can't trust everything that I read on Twitter.
Right.
So I'll take it with a bag of salt every right. time I read it. And that would be another example of the message that comes with the medium, I guess.
Right. And I mean, in my personal research, what I'm also interested in is better ways of getting a sense of people's history of posting, for instance. So, you know, I'd like to see, you know, even now you could click on their name and start reading their posts and everything. But I think there's a better way of being able to make compact representations of, for instance, what people have said on a big public forum like Twitter, so that you'd start getting an idea of, you know, wow, this is, you know, the source of 29, you know, recent false rumors. You know, partly how would people respond to them? When are they followed more? Which are the things they've talked about which have trended more, or have they disappeared more? So I think there's ways of, you know, and then we can look at this, we can analyze an interface like that from a signaling perspective, because one of the things in signaling is that there's receiver costs in analysis. So the first animal paper that wrote about receiver costs, I think, used the example of, you know, frogs out courting. So if you're a female frog, you want to figure out which of these other frogs has the best quality. You go to this thing called a lek, and all the male frogs are out there singing their little hearts out. You can sit and listen and see which one seems the most attractive. But you have a bunch of frogs sitting outside and singing, it's going to attract all the frog predators. So it's actually kind of dangerous to sit there and listen too long. So there, the cost of the longer you listen, the more reliable your assessment might be, but the more danger you're in. So there's always some kind of cost, even if it's just opportunity cost, in assessing how reliable something is. And so with Twitter right now, if I want to get a sense of somebody's posting and their posting history and how others reacted to them, I could sit and research them all day. And if it's important enough, I might, but I don't normally do that for every posting. Whereas if I could click on their name and get a very well-designed graphic that sort of shows what they've done and where their following's picked up and how they've been retweeted and what they retweet, I could have this very compact representation of the information I need to make that assessment.
And is that something you're trying to do with your research then, mm-hmm. to try to create a model to aggregate this information about people through their Twitter stream?
Right. I mean, I'm sort of work on two separate but related pieces. Is one is the signaling work that's about this very theoretical analysis of communication. And then my other work is designing online systems and interfaces like that. What's useful for me is that they should, you know, at least complement each other. So, for instance, I can say, with something like that, that type of data portrait, I can say it's not just a nice thing, but here's this whole way of looking at communication that shows how important that can be. It's important because I think as more and more information is out there about us, having a good understanding of what's known about us, how does it all balance, is very important. You know, even with something like the status updates, just being able to get a sense of like, what is it that I talk about all the time? You know, if this is my window onto the world, you know, what am I showing through it?
There's something interesting about online communication that seems very deliberate, mm-hmm. that you have to engage very actively to mm-hmm. put words down right. into a status update box right. and press return and say, this is at this moment at 3:30 p.m. on a Tuesday, this is what I have to say yeah. about the way I'm living my life. Are there also kind of passive ways of communicating online?
Well, it depends on the interface, right? So for instance, I'm not advocating this. I'm just saying you could do this. If Facebook, for instance, said, well, we're going to just have a little thing on your profile that's just a little histogram of when you're logged in. Maybe you didn't say anything, because one of the things I don't know, there's people who I am connected to and they've never posted anything. They've certainly never posted a comment on my page. I have no idea if they, and sometimes if someone will come up to me and say, oh, I knew blah, 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 that's great. Like, okay, I've never sort of seen you there. But they're online all the time. They just read and read and read. Yes, but if there was a little histogram that said, okay, well, here's, you know, how often this person's been on and how long, or, you know, you could have another site, again, it's a privacy issue, that said, and this is where they visited. You might not want that, but it would certainly make it less passive. So I think what we'll see is hopefully it's like a range of online spaces, some of which give people a tremendous amount of privacy, and some where privacy is given up not necessarily for marketing and advertising, which is what usually we think of giving up privacy for, but for being more of a community, where you can really see what other people are doing when they're not active. You know, I think as long as that's done in a way that it's very viscerally clear that everything you do is tracked and you see it and you know it and you're aware of it, not that it's off in your subconscious. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a privacy issue. It's just, it's a very public space. Well, they certainly have all that data. It's, you know, to what extent do they make that data public either to you or mm-hmm. public to the world at large?
It would be interesting to get access to that kind of information, because they could definitely trace if you're at home on a Friday night and you've just broken up with your boyfriend or girlfriend and you're just looking through their photos, you could yeah. just take a map of where are they going, little breadcrumbs.
Like, right. Yeah. No, I mean, there's a right. So and if Facebook suddenly made all of this public, it would be horrible, because people have done all these things with the expectation that that's not public. But if you design a site from the beginning that says, oh, you know, here, every time you go around here, here's the map of where you were and what you were doing, and everyone else can see it, it's a very different type of space. You know, it doesn't make as much sense for something as personal and social, but it might make sense for a much more professional site where, you know, it's like between a large group of collaborators who are working on different projects. If you wanted to do a social networking site for, you know, a company, you might want to say, yeah, we want to see, you know, where people are going and what they're doing, and everyone should have this map of where everyone else is. Sort of like saying, we're going to have a company, we're going to have a big open loft-like space, and you come into work and you see what everyone's doing.
Well, I think we've roamed around in a lot of interesting territory, and I want to give you the opportunity to kind of bring it back to what you're doing and tell me where you're planning on going from here.
Well, mostly what I'm doing is writing. So I'm writing two books, one on signaling and one on design. So that's somewhat takes up a lot of my time at the moment. So mostly where I'm taking it is in the design realm, trying to look at these notions of, you know, large data portraits, what happens as we move increasingly into a world of ubiquitous communication, et cetera. What are some of the privacy issues? What are the issues around open versus closed communities? And a lot of these big design questions of thinking about how do we convey information visually and interactively. And then on the signaling side, I'm mostly looking at, you know, really understanding phenomena such as fashions, open source, you know, to what extent open source is gift-like in nature as a signal of cooperation, looking at ultimately issues around how do we signal that we're human? So some really basic pieces there. Getting back to Turing's machine and the question of, you know, whether we can tell someone is human or not. The Turing test is essentially a big signaling problem. And I think one that in various ways we're going to be facing quite a bit in the next few years.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Judith Dunneth is the director of the Sociable Media Research Group at MIT and a fellow at the Berkman Center. You can find out more about her, including a link to her book in progress on signals, truth, and design, at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.